One thing we know about life is that nobody gets out of it alive. The loss of a loved one can be traumatic. Surviving the loss is a process that ebbs and flows. This hour on the Ideas Network, we're going to talk about proactive ways to deal with grief. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine today. Have you lost a loved one? What was your grief process like? Did you follow the 5 steps of grief as outlined in the Kubler-Ross book from 1969? Did you create your own roadmap? Do you think there's a proactive way to deal with grief? Let us hear from you this morning at 800-642-1234. My guest is Lori Dubensky, a UW health psychologist and adjunct clinical assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. In her research, she has studied bereavement issues. Welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So let's start with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's landmark book from 1969, which more or less redefined how we think about death and mourning. She wrote about the 5 stages of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. But researchers really haven't found very much evidence that these stages exist. How was this discovered?
Well, Kubler-Ross had done this work through her experience working with people who were dying and noticing the kinds of experiences they had and how they faced their own mortality, as well as later work that looked at the survivors and as they grieved. And so she found that there were these things that people tended to do that popular culture has taken on as stages or steps that they expect people to go through sequentially. But what we found is people do have these experiences, but they don't necessarily happen in those in that order or that stages. That denial may or may not come. Anger may come second, or it may come before anything else, or it may resurface later after going through other experiences. But what we know is that grief is very complex. A group of emotions, and it can include anger and sadness and fear and guilt, but it can also include positive emotions like relief or hope for new beginnings or other things, and they can all happen at the same time, or they can happen changing throughout the day or throughout months and over a long period of time. So we're finding it's much more complex.
Well, my understanding is that if Elizabeth Kubler-Ross could write that book over again, she would have used words like phases or factors or experiences rather than stages.
Absolutely. It's been noted that when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was dying, she expressed the regret that word stage had been used and interpreted that way, that she did understand at the time that they were just factors or experiences and not necessarily meaning them to be a sequential step of stages that people would have to go through.
So that kind of frames, though, what we now consider kind of the traditional model of bereavement. But how do people experience this?
Well, people experience bereavement very differently. It's important to understand that every person is different in their bereavement process or their healing from loss, but also within an individual person, they may experience bereavement different, whether it's a loss of one loved one versus a loss of another. So even as a single person, bereavement isn't the same for you every time you face a loss. So it's really individualized to the nature of the relationship that you had and what the loss of that relationship means.
Well, and I mean, you know, there are we know that life is finite. I mean, at some point we're going to be gone, and so there are some I don't know if you could call them death events. I mean, there are some passings that are kind of expected. You know, you expect the person who maybe has reached the age of 105, at some point, you know, they're just not going to be here, as opposed to, say, when a child dies or something like that. And so, I mean, there are those kinds of differences, or what your relationship was with that person can affect then how deeply we are impacted by that.
Absolutely. And so when we expect a death or planning, facing the end of life, it's a different process than when a death happens suddenly or unexpectedly. And so that can certainly intensify the shock around the death experience, but it also still doesn't change the fact that a relationship that we had is no longer, and that somebody that we've grown close to and may have relied on for connection is no longer available for the same kind of connections we had. And so even those expected deaths can still harbor a lot of intense grief experience.
Now, there was a 2002 study that showed the main symptoms of grief to be grief, shock, anxiety, intrusive thoughts, and depression, and that the symptoms often lifted within 6 months. There's also this this swinging pendulum analogy that I'm finding in some of the literature. How do these symptoms make contribute to that?
So the swinging pendulum is this idea that grief comes in waves, and sometimes it's very intense, and sometimes it sort of disappears into the background of our lives, and then it can surface again. And the idea is at the beginning, when somebody dies, that immediate time for half the people, about 6 months, is a real intense period of those feelings that may be present more often than not. And then as time goes on, those symptoms can be, or those feelings, are present less and less, but then instances where they rise to the surface and they can be quite intense. And those are times often when there's a reminder, you know, maybe an anniversary, like when the loved one's birthday comes about, or a wedding anniversary, or the holidays, different things that can trigger those grief emotions to rise to the surface. And so the study that you're talking about found that about 50%, half of the people, are kind of not having these experiences that much after 6 months. But that also means that half of the people are going to experience these symptoms for longer. And oftentimes it's up to potentially 2 years after the death that people can still have pretty intense feelings of grief.
Yeah, and do we have any idea why that is?
Why some people may experience it longer?
Yeah.
I think, again, it goes back to, well, everybody's different in terms of their attachment and their emotional experience. Some people are more vulnerable towards depression, and so the depression part of grief may linger just because they may have had depression prior to grief. They may, because of the nature of their relationship, might have been so entwined that it's harder for them to find a life outside of their experiences with that loved one. So that may be different than somebody who may have been more independent anyways, and it's easier for them to move forward with other activities. So there can be lots of different individual reasons why some people hold on to those intense grief feelings longer than others.
Well, and sometimes we feel guilty about moving on. Why is that?
Well, I think sometimes there's a pressure, whether it's social pressure or personal pressure, to that fear that moving on means forgetting, or if you move on too quickly, it may mean that to others your relationship didn't mean as much as it was. So I think sometimes people feel guilt about moving on as a reflection of not wanting to tarnish the memory or lose the memory or lose the closeness that they feel to that person who is gone. Sometimes there's a fear that if they move forward, they may forget, and wanting to hold on to that loved one out of a yearning to be close to them, they're afraid to let go of their grief.
And are there some identifiable manifestations of this survivor's guilt?
Well, oftentimes people are aware of it. They'll say, you know, I just can't bear to do something different, or you know, other people have looked disfavorably upon me when I've mentioned maybe remarrying, or so some people are aware of either the social pressure that they have or their own feelings, but it can look like being stuck and being stuck with a lot of intense periods of crying and yearning and maybe a lot of time spent in remembrance, looking over photos and connection to someone rather than engaging in different opportunities or different relationships and moving forward.
And we're warned about, for example, if someone loses a spouse after a long marriage, the common wisdom is, well, don't make any big changes for 6 months to a year, you know, because you don't want to be to be considering large changes when you're still, when your grief is still fresh. Is that still true?
I think that's generally good advice in the concern that people might act impulsively. So in the midst of the intense grief, you may want to rid your house of all reminders and be done with that, and then later come back and regret that you don't have something. So I think that's the advice that still holds true, but that doesn't mean somebody can't make a good decision to make a change. And for some people, that change may be the very thing they need. If the death was traumatic and if it happened in the home and that brings about traumatic reactions for the person, it's probably best that that person move out of that home. But, you know, so there are, again, examples where you can find exceptions to that rule. But in general, it's still something that you don't want people making large impulsive decisions that they may later regret because they don't have the opportunity to go back and get those things that would provide comfort later in the grieving process when the reminders won't bring up as much intense negative feeling as it would bring up comfort. But early on, it brings up these intense emotions and they want to rid that experience.
Well, one of the emotions that we associate with mourning has been anger. Who are we mad at?
Depending on the nature of the death, some people are mad at the person for leaving. Some people are angry at God. Some people are angry at the disease. Anger is often a manifestation of deep hurt and sorrow that is harder to express. And so it comes out as anger against something. And so I work a lot with people facing cancer, and I've seen people be very angry at the disease, very angry in their religious beliefs of prayer and hope that they would be cured and they're not. And people, you know, after somebody is gone, you know, definitely can feel angry that they're gone. And certainly in tragic cases or in cases of suicide, that anger can really be strong towards the person who has left.
And how are we supposed to deal with that? Because it's a very real thing, but it's certainly not healthy, I would think. How is a person supposed to deal with that?
With the anger specifically, it's often helpful to get an understanding that the anger is covering up this intense sorrow, and to get someone more in touch with the sorrow of the loss, and that sadness can sometimes help. Help them find solutions in a way that anger doesn't often have solutions. So when you feel there's just a deep regret for things, then you can look at what was done in the past and what you regret and figure out how to make amends in that. And you may not be able to have a conversation with your loved one, obviously, and apologize or fix that relationship, but you can do things symbolically. Writing them a letter sometimes can help, expressing that feeling that they wish things had been different in some way. Taking that anger, all that energy, and putting it towards a cause or something that you're very passionate about is one way to transition that angry energy into something more proactive and help release it in a way. So there are a lot of different strategies, but it often really involves identifying exactly what it is, and that sometimes that's triggering the anger, and that often can then give us direction to what kinds of problem-solving or solutions we need to look at.
We're talking about grief and what can be done about it. One of the things we're going to get into before the end of the hour is some more proactive ways to deal with grief. My guest is Lori Dubensky, a UW Health psychologist and adjunct clinical assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. She'll be with me for the rest of the hour. You can join us, too, at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email address is talk@WPR.org, and you can also leave a comment or question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The loss of a loved one can be traumatic. Surviving it is a process that ebbs and flows, and we all experience it in a unique way. What we're doing this hour is discussing several proactive ways to deal with grief. My guest is Lori Dubensky, UW Health psychologist and adjunct clinical assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. In her research, she has studied bereavement issues. So, what questions should a person ask themselves when going through the grieving process?
Well, I think it's important for people to reflect on what the loss means to them. What is changed in their lives because that person isn't there? The losses of somebody are also compiled with losses of social networks. So oftentimes when somebody loses a spouse, they may lose the friends and the friendship networks that their spouse used to organize for them. If they lose a friend, they may lose the one person they used to go to for certain kinds of advice or consoling. And so recognizing that the loss of the person means a lot of different changes in their lives, and that helps people to start understanding where they may need to compensate, where they may need to find ways to fill that void, where they may need to just recognize that something is going to be different for the rest of their lives and what that means. And so, you know, questions about what feelings they're really having towards these different aspects of loss really help to produce a sense of direction that they may go rather than simply being stuck in the feelings of loss.
We have some callers who want to join us. Let's take a call first from Cindy in Oshkosh. Cindy, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Very close to my heart subject. I lost my oldest son in 2003. And for me personally, I feel like I'm still grieving. Every time I see someone his age with a family or doing things as a family together, I feel a sadness and a loss. I lost two more sons in 2012, excuse me. And I still feel sadness, loss. I still feel that I'm grieving. I did go through the stage of anger. I still feel angry that my lost my first son and also the other two. I did go through extensive counseling. It's just something that you just don't get over your whole life. I've accepted it, you know, even though it still upsets me. I mean, I've accepted that they're gone and I have moved on. I try to keep very busy because the less time that I have to think about it or to feel those feelings, the better I can keep my composure. I did go and seek out a medium, which probably was the most helpful for me to touch base with, because there was questions surrounding all their deaths that were unanswered, and to touch base with them through a medium was very helpful for me. That was probably the thing that helped me the most. Understanding, you know, and blaming myself for not being there for them, being a better person, being a better mom, you know, whatever. And that kind of justified some of my questions, you know, like, you know, mom, you were great, you know, it wasn't you, and stuff like that. So just wanted to share a little bit of how I felt. I didn't notice that I had, like, the stages. I know you said they weren't stages, but, you know, I did relate to some of them, but I don't think when you have that type of loss that you ever really get over it.
Cindy, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us this morning. Lori?
Absolutely. Cindy, you're absolutely right, and particularly with losses of children, that's one of the losses that we know parents who've lost children continue to have really intense grief. That's one of the most difficult griefs to heal from, and to have multiple losses, as Cindy has, is very difficult. She's brought up several, I think, really important points for people to think about. One is that, you know, even though that she's found acceptance that it's happened, acceptance doesn't necessarily mean having to believe that it's okay, that you don't have to be you know, people say, how would I ever accept that? I didn't want it to happen. And there's a way that acceptance can be not an either or, but an acceptance and still angry that it happened or still sad that it happened. And to get to that point is difficult. The other things that she mentioned is, in fact, keeping busy as a way of distracting from those feelings or keeping them from surfacing it can be a very positive coping strategy. Some people think about denial or avoidance as negatives, but they're not always that way. Sometimes we need the space, we need the avoidance, we need to not be thinking about it in order to sort of recoup our resources to cope with it later. So taking time away, taking a break from the intensity of it is a very proactive way of coping in some instances, as long as the distraction and the avoidance aren't keeping you from doing important things in your life. So that's a very important thing, too, that I'm glad she mentioned. And the thing about seeking a medium, that's something that people are doing and oftentimes not talking about. But what we find is it's not uncommon for people going through intense bereavement to seek out psychic experience, to either feel a psychic connection or to go seek a medium or to be looking for that connection to other energies in the universe as a means of coping. And some people, as Cindy has, have found that to be one of the most helpful things that they've experienced during their grieving process. So I'm glad she mentioned that as well.
She also brought up sort of the parental guilt. Was I a good enough mother, or did I do something wrong? And I think for most parents who have lost a child or children in this case, that would also be a factor.
Absolutely. And in my work, I work with a lot of family caregivers caring for somebody dying of cancer. And I know in their experience, if that caregiving situation didn't go well, they'll always second guess, could we have done something differently? Could I have made a difference? And I can only imagine that in the context of a parent being a caregiver for somebody so dependent and always questioning, what could have been different in our lives? What could I have done? Is something to really struggle with. And it sounds like in some ways Cindy has found those answers in the psychic medium that was able to find reassurance from her son in that format. But there are other ways that people can work through the guilt in terms of reflecting on the positive experiences to sort of explain that they didn't do things wrong. They were a good parent. And then sometimes the truth is the relationship wasn't good. And so then somebody can't necessarily convince themselves that it was when it wasn't, but then maybe would benefit from making amends with some sort of symbolic apology or acknowledgement that things hadn't gone well, that they made mistakes and moving forward from there. So again, that nature of that relationship that you bring into the bereavement experience is very important and has a large impact on how well you move through the healing of grief.
We're talking about grief and grieving and bereavement with Lori Dubensky, UW Health psychologist, and wondering what you all think about it. 800-642-1234. You've been listening, you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, 800-642-1234. talk@WPR.org is the email address, and you can also post to the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's take a call next from Joe in Black River Falls. Joe, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I lost a son back in 1985, January 22nd. He was 6 months, 5 days old. And I had set my alarm that morning at 5 o'clock because I was going for a job. I've been driving a semi for 32 years. Well, I woke up at 6 o'clock, and my wife said, check the baby, and I did. And it was too late. I tried, wanted to give mouth-to-mouth, and all I could do was stand there. I think I'm a pretty tough guy. And anyway, I couldn't do nothing, you know. It's too late. But I was so mad that he died of crib death. And every time he had a sniffle, I took him to the doctor. I mean, he was my first son. And you know, I was so mad I screamed and hollered at God after that. And you know, I've never really gotten over it. It's taken me a good 20 years. I've got another son. He's 7 now. And I guess when Taylor came along, it helped me. You know, I love God. I pray so much. You know, I mean, not to the paranoid stage, but I call. I need to hear him. I need to touch him. You know, I need to smell him. Ever since I lost my first boy, it's taken me a long time. And just the last few days, probably 4 days, after screaming and calling God everything I could think of, which I know is wrong now, but I finally gave my life to God here the other day, and I can breathe. But, you know, it's a tough road. And I know I'm not a help to anybody else, but it just helps to talk sometimes. And I thank you for your time.
Joe, thanks for sharing your story with us this morning. Appreciate hearing from you. Lori?
Absolutely. And those kinds of deaths, when you're present for it, it's an intense experience, you're helping to try to change that outcome and feeling helpless, can definitely cause lingering trauma for quite some time after, and needing to find ways to do that. So initially, yelling at God over the unfairness of that, I can certainly understand that. And, you know, Joe says that he understands now that it's wrong in terms of turning back to faith, but also understanding that emotions are never wrong. They're expressions of exactly what you're going through. And sometimes in the intensity of them, we react ways that we wouldn't imagine reacting. We can't imagine going through something like that. You know, his tragedy has lingered with him for a long time and will always, because, again, that's an experience of losing a child that is so hard to, you just never let go of that and wouldn't expect somebody to. But finding faith, as he said, and talking about it helps. I think giving voice to the loss. And the other thing that's important for people who have lost, and particularly for parents who have lost a child, is people express that other people don't acknowledge their grief the way that they need to, need people to. So people stop saying the person's name. They stop talking about them. When babies are born, people think, well, if you go on to have other children, that should take that place. And that's just not the case. And for those parents, they, you know, are still parents and still have that child, but nobody's talking about the child. Nobody's giving some life and some memory to that lost person. And so continuing to talk about that person, continuing to talk about, you know, the baby that he lost and using the baby's name and working through his trauma around the exact death experience. He may be having flashback experience of that and could benefit. Some people could benefit from trauma counseling because the death experience was traumatizing, can be very helpful.
Let's take a call from Tom in Madison next. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. My own experience of grief has been, I've experienced it in the case of physical death of some people. Certainly nothing as traumatic as what the two previous callers had. But I've also experienced grief in relationship to other experiences in life. So I think the physical death is one example of the grieving process that we all go through. But I think we grieve over a lot of other things. Any kind of loss of, like, for example, retirement or divorce, or there's so many other losses in life that we grieve in these phases of grief that are so dramatically experienced with these severe physical deaths are experienced in a lot of other ways in life. That's been my experience.
Tom, thanks for sharing that insight. Lori Dubensky, that would seem to be very true.
That is absolutely true. Tom's right. Grief is a response that we have to loss. And loss occurs anytime change occurs. So when everything changes, even change for the positive, means that, something else is no longer the way it used to be. And there's a loss to that. And so people do experience these same kind of grief feelings at various intensities for those exact things. Retirement, so the loss of the job. And that goes back to what I was saying about recognizing all the losses that are involved in this experience. So like with retirement, you can imagine you've lost your job, but you've also lost the social connection you had with your coworkers every day and having that daily connection, and now you may not if you're at home, and having a sense of purposeness in your day, or feeling productive, and all the things, the financial piece that comes along with that. So within every loss experience, there's actually many smaller losses that could be identified, and some are very big and obvious, and some are actually quite small. When I work with the people I do who have cancer, we used to talk about having anticipatory grief, and it used to be described as this, you're grieving your eventual death, or for their loved ones, they're anticipating the loss that's going to come. But we're understanding more that that isn't really a grief in the anticipation. You can't pre-grieve somebody's loss, but it's real grief that they're experiencing in the losses that come along the way. So the grief of the loss of their health, and the grief of the loss of their no longer being able to work because they're sick, and the loss of physical intimacy maybe because of their experience, or the loss of time that they would spend with children or with hobbies. And so, again, recognizing all of those smaller losses can sometimes inform ways that we could compensate for or address those losses along the way. But, yeah, Tom is absolutely right. There's a lot of different things that we experience grief for in our lives.
Tom, thanks for that call. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you'd like to join the program. Lori Dubensky is my guest. We will be continuing our discussion about grief. And when we come back, Lori, I'd like to talk about what are some proactive ways to deal with grief. Research indicates there are some, and I'd like to hear what they are. And then we've got some other topics we want to cover before the end of this hour as well. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about grief and grieving this hour with Lori Dubensky, UW Health Psychologist and Adjunct Clinical Assistant Professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And wondering what your ideas and stories are at 800-642-1234. Well, Lori, research indicates there are proactive ways to deal with grief. Let's talk about those for just a moment.
Well, certainly, by being proactive, it means doing something to address the problem rather than being more passive and just experiencing it and waiting for things to change. And so thinking about when you've experienced a loss, initially there's going to be a lot of emotion that you experience, but what we want to do is find ways to help move forward from those feelings and bring more positivity into our lives. And so that's where being proactive and being active and finding those positive experiences becomes important. And so ways to do that are certainly by examining what's important to you. What would you find meaningful to do with the time that you have, or a meaningful direction to place that negative energy that we talked about. And so people have been proactive in terms of finding connection with other people who are moving with grief, so starting support groups of other similar experiences, so parents who have lost children, young widows groups, ways that you can connect with someone who shares a similar experience. But then not just sitting around and talking about how sad it is, but being active in what you're doing. So using that time together to do something social that maybe you wouldn't feel comfortable doing on your own and you used to do with your spouse. So that would be proactively re-engaging in activities that otherwise you would be missing out on. Other directions would be to find volunteer work or a cause that's really important. So we see this often in families that have gone through some sort of loss, and then they take on the cause of the illness that they may have had or the situation. So getting involved in Mothers Against Drunk Driving or cancer support kinds of causes or things like that, and being really involved can also be a proactive place to put that energy. But really it's a matter of searching within yourself to say, what do I feel is missing in my life now? And what can I do to make up for that? Where is some direction I can start to put that energy?
We had a caller who wanted to know about the grief we experience on behalf of others. This caller is a grandmother. Her child lost a child a few years ago. She also said she established rituals to help her deal with the loss, like bringing flowers to the grave. Any thoughts on that?
Ritual is a very effective way for people to deal with that kind of loss. Oftentimes, we want some sort of closure around that death experience, and that's what ceremony and funerals can do. It gives you an opportunity to gather a bunch of people who share the loss and really then not feel so isolated in your feelings, to say, yes, this has really happened. And it takes away some of that disbelief or surrealism of the experience by recognizing that with other people. And then moving forward, other ritual can help put a marker on that, make it a little bit more tangible and connect to that. So bringing flower to the grave is one common ritual. Other rituals might include prayer or meditation on certain important days or anniversaries of the loss, or other rituals have been, I've seen or heard people doing, like setting an empty place at the first holiday table so that you can acknowledge that person's presence, or carrying on a tradition that person may have done. So putting a special ornament on the Christmas tree for them, or using a decoration they would have used, or lots of different ways that we can incorporate ritual. But that can really help people connect with that experience and connect with that person.
Tom is on the line with us from Milwaukee. Let's go to that call next. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. First of all, just on a real quick note, I was driving, I heard this program, and I was actually taken aback because you very rarely ever listening to radio or TV hear anybody talk about grief. And it is in our society one of those things that passed over, glazed over in so many conversations because it's uncomfortable. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to hear about it. And the more intense the situation or the grief, the faster people want to get past it. It's something they don't want to talk about. There's very little research on it. There's very few organizations that deal with it. And so, I just want to say, thank you for getting the program on the air. We lost our son going on 4 years ago. And, he was a math wizard. He was going into biomedical engineering. He was getting ready to start college, and he died 3 weeks before school started. It was an experience that we never dreamed of before. Even though my wife and I both lost both of our parents, before we hit our 40s, it's something that we did not expect. And when he died, it just made life just enough to be able to function and get by. Everybody wanted to move past it quickly. They wanted to, get past the grief and just the incidents and the things that happened, in the days, weeks, months, and now years after. Have been fairly surprising, and they're stories that, you don't hear out in the open. They're having to get lawyers involved, to reclaim custody of your child because a funeral home took possession that shouldn't have out of state. It's family involving themselves in your life, and then, making it the problem of the bereaved parents. These are all things that, people find ways to take advantage of in a bereaved, grief-stricken environment, whether it be, people taking money, you know, on behalf of them and then not giving it out, or, you know, embedding themselves in relationships and then taking those relationships that were once important. These are things that are just accepted in society, and it's something that is in our society is so glazed over. And, you know, when you look at incidents like Newtown and you're a parent sitting on that couch and you understand what those parents are going through and you're looking at it and you're just sick with all of the media coverage and the follow-up and all the takeaway from, you know, get what they can out of those parents. And then in the end, the parents are still left with the fact their child is gone, but somebody's taken something. So it's just that there is no compassion in society. You know, there's no compassion in corporations when you lose a child and you're expected to be back at work in 4 days. Or you lose a spouse. I mean, it's not just relegated to a child, but it is much more so an intense feeling, as some of your other callers have said.
Tom, thanks for sharing that with us. Lori, what about it? As a society, how compassionate are we?
Well, I think Tom was absolutely right when he was saying that as a society, we don't acknowledge grief as much as we used to. It's not a part of our lives. It's something that we want to cover up and sweep under the rug. And at the same time, there are people who take advantage of people during vulnerable times, and certainly injustices that happen in that process because we don't understand how people grieve or acknowledge what people are needing in the immediate and in the long term. I think, too, he speaks to that sense that society and media is sort of obsessed with and eager to get the story about a tragedy and the events about the tragedy, but not the lingering effects on the people and the souls that experience that tragedy. And so the incidents get sensationalized, but he's right. The people are left having to pick up the pieces, and we don't often hear those stories of how they move forward with that and what their personal side is. And family and friends do want to be done and kind of wrap it up in a neat little package and feel like, okay, we supported them, and now I need to move on. I need to believe that can't happen to me.
Well, it makes us uncomfortable. It makes us uncomfortable. It's awkward, and so we want to just not, you know, we want to make it go away.
Yeah, and, you know, 150 years or so ago, we weren't like that. Death happened in the home. It happened frequently. And we rallied as a family to ease someone through that, and we wore clothing of, you know, black clothing to acknowledge mourning, and we had more ceremony and more connection, and then society moved forward with institutionalizing death, and people die in hospitals, funeral industry came up. People used to bury their own family members, and now that's a disconnection. And there's laws and regulation about things now that keep us more separate from that experience. But the emotions are still very raw, and they don't have the same place that they used to have in society to put forward. And so that has been one of the things that people are interested in a movement towards is more recognition that there can be a good death and that there can be good bereavement, but we need to find ways to help acknowledge that in our society to help people bring it out and move forward. And some interesting things are coming up of that. So, you know, we're a different society, and you know, there's been some use of social media and technology to help people in that respect as well, and finding similar others and avenues for expressing their grief.
Well, there's a Facebook group for parents who have lost children, mm-hmm. for example.
Yes.
Let's try and I want to get this call in here before we lose all the time. Ellen in Milwaukee, we'll go to you next. Ellen, thanks for joining us.
Hi. 2 years ago this month, my husband died. 3 months later, my sister, who lives about 600 miles away, was diagnosed with glioblastoma, which is a deadly brain cancer. And then she died last December. And I was lucky in the sense that I was in a position I could spend almost the entire year down there with my sister. It certainly interrupted dealing with my husband's death, but it beyond that, it piled the worst grief I could ever imagine on top of it. Losing a sister is like, oh my God, nothing I could ever have imagined. But losing my husband made me realize how uncompassionate I have been over the years. My daughter and I talked about that, you know, that we could never, ever hear of somebody losing anybody and not be more compassionate and not realize how hard it is after the noise goes away. And in the case of a spouse, the lack of touch, people stop touching you, and you starve. You just starve to be just touched. And I've nothing else. I have developed a compassion that I never had before. And I also recognize I couldn't judge anybody for anything they did in grief. If somebody was married 2 weeks after their spouse died, glory, hallelujah. If they take 4 years, I'm so sorry. In the year while I was out of town, I reconnected with a boyfriend from seventh grade who I hadn't seen in 50 years. And so on top of not having done my husband's grief thing and all the other stuff, and I find myself in love, and I recognize that isn't standard. And I could never judge anybody else. My cousin, whose husband died suddenly, called it a peculiar solitude, and I think there's not a better description for it. You are so cut off from everybody, even if you're in the middle of a packed room. And I think compassion, you know, is just something we have got to learn.
Ellen, thanks so much for your call, and we've only got about a minute and a half or so left, but Lori, I know you've got something you'd like to say about that.
Well, I just commemorate Ellen on her recognition of a direction for personal growth to come from this. Definitely those compiled tragedies can, an unexpected directions your life may go come of that. And so recognizing that there is good and it's different for everybody, and we can't judge what somebody else is doing because we don't know what that experience is. And peculiar solitude is definitely an experience I hear a lot about, and that's that sort of aha moment when you're in a room full of people who have gone through a similar experience, that there's suddenly an instant connection. I think it's filling that void of feeling like I'm the only one in the world who's ever gone through this, and I'm all alone, and it's important for us to rally around those people and help them move forward.
Very quickly, before we go here, when should we be seeking counseling for this? How do we know when I'm in trouble here, I need to get some help?
Well, first, I always recommend seeking counseling when you're not liking how your life is going and you can't figure out a different way. So when it's bothersome to you, then it's good to see somebody to help. There's no time, you know, if it makes sense to come in right away. If something was particularly traumatic and you're having flashbacks, the earlier you get in for help with that, the better you will be in terms of your ability to move forward from that. If things are lingering for a long time, getting help, or if suddenly something changes and you're struck with intensity. So again, whenever you feel like you could use a little help, just checking in with
somebody. That's the time. Okay, and we have to go. Lori Dubensky, thanks so much for this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Lori Dubensky is a UW health psychologist and adjunct clinical assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine. Robin Cherry produced this hour of programming. Christy Taylor handled on-air production. Bill Martins was my director. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.